Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Since the success of the civil rights movement with the Voting Rights Act and the Fair Housing Act, the War on Poverty program, America and its politics has been moving farther and farther and farther to the right. We are also now seeing this happen in terms of the geopolitical landscape. Why is this happening? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a columnist. He is an activist. He's a writer. John Jeter. John, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
So have you seen and are you seeing what I just talked about in the intro, that we thought with the civil rights movement, with the voting, the legislative successes of the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, with the legal successes from the Warren Court, we saw a number of moves to the left, more in terms of protecting the civil rights and civil liberties of citizens, that since that time, we've seen an ongoing shift to the right, and now it really seems to be culminated with the election of Donald Trump.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. I think there's been, really, there's been a doubling down on the class war in the United States that I would date back to the 1973 stagflation crisis, which capital said they just would not abide by. And really, we've been in the left, liberals, the Democratic Party, if you want to put a big, use a big umbrella, has been in retreat ever since. And I think now we're pretty much in a corner, almost like rats trapped in a corner. And it could go either way.
And it's interesting that you talk about 73. The stagflation, because you remember the period where liberals didn't even want to use the word liberal. They did not want to use the word left. And out of all of that, we came up to Bill Clinton and the Democratic Legislative Council, where he co-opted a lot of Republican ideas, moved the Democratic Party further to the right, and now folks really have no clue what's right, what's left, what's liberal, what's progressive anymore.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, this has to be said because it's often lost in conversations. We rarely talk about these things, but it's often lost even when we do talk about it, which is that with the United States exceptionalism, our exceptionalism, as it were, is not any sort of moral position. It's not even our military strength. Our exceptionalism is that I would say the United States has less class consciousness than any country in the modern era. I don't think you can find any country in the industrial era that has less class consciousness than the United States. And even though it's not perfect, there are times when we do have a class consciousness, and that's when we seem to come together and things move forward. But we're back in that period of time where there's just no glue that connects the American population. We're really like 325 individual people fighting our own separate battles.
Now, elaborate on that, because I would have thought you would have said that right now what we're experiencing is heightened class consciousness. And because class in America takes on a couple of different factors. One is a numeric or economic strata. How much do you make? What is your median household income? And then with that also, there is a psychological element of being what it means to be working class, what it means the middle class, quote unquote, values. Even if you even if you don't make the money that puts you into the middle class, you can still be a working class family with middle class values. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think a lot of what you speak to is a reflection of the effort that the oligarchs, generally, I would say the bondholders specifically, the investors specifically, have put into brainwashing this country. And it's not just the media, both in terms of our cinema and our commercials, and also, of course, our newspapers and broadcast media, but also in terms of our education, in terms of our politics and our political campaigns. There's been this great effort by the elites, by the 1%, if you will, to divide the working class. And by the working class, I mean people who work for a living, who draw a paycheck, and who depend on that paycheck to live, right? And during the New Deal, as one example, of course, you know, we've never had an absence of racism in this country, but there was a move by whites, mostly, because blacks have always pretty much felt this way. There was a move by whites to identify more with blacks who were working people, which was all of us, right? And what you've seen since then, since the 70s, since 1973 specifically, has been this move by the elites to double down on this narrative, this sort of birth of a nation narrative, blacks being unpatriotic, reckless, not very smart. If you're in cahoots with them, you're putting yourself in danger. You're putting your country in danger. And there's been this doubling down on this narrative, and it's served as a wedge to drive us apart. And so we have working people who support Trump, who believe that people like you and me and Muslims and Latinos, people of color, are the problem. Well, we're not the problem. The problem is the elites, the 1%, the rich, people like Donald Trump. That's the problem. That's empirically true. That's objectively true. But of course, and this is, I realize what I'm saying, and I know that it is it's spectacular, but it's true. The elites would much rather have a race war than a class war. And it's not any more complicated than that.
I think that's very succinct and very, very accurate. And it is not only contained to the United States. We see Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's mastermind, who helped to articulate, develop the narrative and articulate this warfare. He's now taking it down to Brazil. And you've got this candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, who may very well become the next president of Brazil. And here he is using a lot of the same narrative of Donald Trump, and it's finding traction in Brazil.
I think that's amazing for a couple of reasons, particularly when you understand that Brazil is really a mirror image of the United States. What I mean by that is, you know, people in the United States, we don't often know this, but I had the great fortune to work as a foreign correspondent years ago in Brazil, actually right when the former leftist, left-wing president for the Workers' Party there, Lula da Silva, was elected president.
And who's now in jail.
Who's now in jail. And this is very important to understand what's going on there. Brazil imported more slaves. They are home to more people of African descent than any country in the world, save Nigeria. Now, that's important because what it tells you is that, or if you bring that forward, Brazil is suffering from almost an identical set of maladies as we are here in the U.S. So, for instance, we talk about Black Lives Matter. Well, this is a much bigger problem in Brazil, where they have not just the police, but these vigilante groups that go around and they shoot blacks with impunity in the streets in Sao Paulo and Rio, all across the country. It's a huge problem, far more in terms of the size of the population per capita than we see here in the United States. They also have tremendous inequality, worse than the United States. It's always been one of the most unequal countries in the world, on par with apartheid South Africa, with Venezuela. Also countries, of course, which have large black populations. And so Brazil is very much a mirror image, and even politically. And what I mean by that is Lula, who ran as a leftist, right? And by leftist, I mean, you know, left of liberalism, as we define it here in the United States. Throughout the world, leftist is something close to a communist, if not a communist. He ran, but he governed as a moderate. And this is important because it was very similar to the way that Bill Clinton governed. Not exactly the same. I don't want to impugn Lula's integrity like that. he wasn't a Republican light, but he was a moderate. And what happened was, while there were some gains, which people were very happy to see, there were some progress for the working class, which people were very happy to see, there wasn't enough. So when the right wing took control in a coup, this was a coup, right? When they got rid of Lula's successor, a woman of color, Dilma, so they referred to everyone in Brazil by their first names. When they got rid of her, there was some consternation. There was movements that mobilized in the streets, but not enough. And the comparison would be to Venezuela. And when Hugo Chavez was overthrown by the right-wing government in 2002, and that country, which is about 12% black, almost the same as the United States in terms of percentage of the population, when they kidnapped the right-wing and who got control of the military, they kidnapped him, took him to a military base, and told the people that he was in Cuba, chilling out with Fidel Castro. They said he wasn't coming back. The people didn't believe that, particularly black people, and specifically black women. And what they did was they got on these ham radios and they said, oh, no, we're going to go get our man back. And that's what they did. They went out there with pots and pans. They stared down the military and they got Hugo Chavez back. And the reason is because he went all the way. It wasn't just this middling centrist compromises. He went all the way. He was actually narrowing inequality. He was reducing poverty. They were on their way to a socialist democracy, a social democracy. That's still the case. I think of all the countries in the Americas where you've seen a movement towards the left over the last 20 years, Venezuela is the one I would bet is most likely to stay intact. Because what you see is this pushback now from the United States, from the right wing, mostly whites in those countries. And the reason we get back to that class consciousness, right? What Hugo Chavez was able to do was awaken the black population, right? And awaken, provoke, ignite their class consciousness. Another country in that region where we can sort of see this, there's something very similar, but my guess is that we'll have a very different result, at least in the short term. Argentina. Argentina is 97% black, mostly, I'm sorry, 97% white, mostly Catholic. Class consciousness is not really an issue, right? They know that when something happens to their neighbor, it could very well happen to them. And so they've also had a right-wing Trump-like candidate take over Argentina. He's now the president of the country, Mauricio Macri. He took over in 2015. My guess is he will not be reelected, and my guess is there is a movement that is now starting to take shape again because they started forming really after the crisis there in Argentina back in the early 2000s. And they're starting to take shape again to strengthen and gain momentum. My guess is they're going to retake their country sooner rather than later. Again, back to Brazil, back to the United States, we don't have that kind of class consciousness. We don't have the politicians who represent working class people in a sort of full body way. And so we kind of, we're of two minds when it comes to our politics, our politicians, what we can do about poverty, what we can do about to help the working class, and what we owe the rich.
And that takes me to my next question. Thank you very much. Talk about that social democracy in Venezuela and the so-called social democratic movement that we keep hearing about from Bernie Sanders and some of his acolytes in the United States.
Yeah, you really can't overstate the level of misinformation in the United States, and I mean by all of our institutions. And so we define these things, whether it's Marxism or social democracy or socialism, we define them very differently than you'll see in many other countries. I think Bernie Sanders likely would have beaten Donald Trump. I'm not sure if that will be the case in 2020, although my guess is he won't be the nominee. I think he might have beaten Donald Trump. I think he is his proposals and his policies are representative of what the working class wants. And that's a positive thing. But you can't compare that to what Hugo Chavez did. And I'll say something else. I'll step out on a limb. You can't compare that to what Hugo Chavez did, because that was an empowerment of the people. It was a grassroots, bottom-up movement where Hugo Chavez's strength came from the people. And they, in turn, they sort of fed off each other. You know, and that's not – Bernie Sanders didn't do that. And we really haven't seen a politician do that on a national level since Jesse Jackson, right? And he fell far short of the glory. We know that. And I think we're also going to see it. This is my prediction. I like to call myself Adamus, Dr. Leon. So this is my prediction. I think we're also going to see it in South Africa next year. I think this Marxist-minded Economic Freedom Fighters, this party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, led by young blacks in South Africa, I think it's going to become the ruling party. That's just my guess. They're very Marxist-oriented. Older blacks still prefer Nelson Mandela's party, of course, but it's a young country. And I think because they are talking about socialist policies, really very hard and fast socialist policies, because inequality there is worse now than it was during apartheid. So I think you're seeing this all over the world. Different countries have different responses. The United States and Brazil, I think we're going to be slower on the uptake because we don't have that kind of class consciousness, which is the predicate for real revolution.
Well, I think also a big problem here is, to your point about Venezuela and Chavez, that it was a grassroots organization. It was a grassroots movement that was embraced by the top, as in Chavez.
Yes, here, yes, exactly.
Here what you have are Bernie Sanders acolytes trying to integrate into an established Democratic Party where Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the Democratic establishment want to have absolutely nothing to do with this and are doing everything in their power to undermine it.
No question. And you see that even with these candidates, too. It's a young woman from Queens, I believe.
Yes.
I think she's a Dominican woman. And she ran as a leftist. And even now, she's starting to moderate her positions on some things. You see these things very clearly. I think the young brother in Florida who's running for governor, I believe he's done the same thing. And that's because of it's a top-down organization.
In fact, wait. Let me give you one quick Mr. Gilliam, let me give you one quick example of Gilliam, and that is he was very quick to come out against the BDS movement. He was very clear in saying, if a BDS piece of legislation comes across my desk as governor, I'm going to veto it. And my thing was, damn, dude, how can you be progressive and anti-BDS?
Right. And Israel is really a litmus test for whether or not you're a committed leftist or you're a committed.
There you go.
I mean, it really is a litmus test, you know. Yeah,
I know it's mine.
That's really disappointing. That's very disappointing to hear that. I did not know that about that brother. That's really disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that underscores another point, which is really very important, which is that it's not just that the elites have been able to divide the white working class from everyone else. They've been really successful. You have to give the devil his due. They've managed to turn a significant number of blacks against other working class people, including our own people.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what people like Gilliam represent. Cory Booker's the Kamala Harris, who is the attorney general in California, wouldn't even prosecute someone for illegally foreclosing on the homes of working class people, even though her own staff recommended that she prosecute them. See, this is the kind of contradiction. These kinds of contradictions are what's really at work here. It's not that Donald Trump is that vastly popular. It's that the Democrats don't offer a viable alternative.
Cory Booker sides with the pharmaceutical companies, which is one reason why we can't get cheaper pharmaceuticals. Like John Jeter, I got to stop you there. The one thing I can't control is the clock. So, hey, man, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate, as always, you coming on, because you bring it every time you come on the Critical Hour. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
All right, folks. All right. You're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. On February 12, 2018, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees reported that there were almost 4.5 million internally displaced persons, IDPs, in the Democratic Republic of Congo and 630,500 refugees in neighboring countries. The IDP population had nearly doubled in the previous year alone, according to my next guest. The imperial aggressions of Western governments have inflicted multiple holocausts on the Congolese people. What's going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo and why? For answers, we turn to an independent journalist, prize-winning journalist for the Black Agenda Report, to discuss her article published today entitled Congo in the Abyss. Anne Garrison, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Before we get to this, there's a story that's just developed. In fact, you just sent me the link. Representatives of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs have sent a letter to Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno demanding that Julian Assange be handed over to authorities. The letter threatens that the United States will be unwilling to provide economic cooperation with Ecuador unless the WikiLeaks founder and political refugee is handed over. Your thoughts on this act of really extortion by the United States?
Absolutely, it's extortion, and it's chilling. I had thought for a while that perhaps the U.S. didn't really want to extradite Julian Assange, because if they do, they're going to have a perception management problem. They're in control of most of the dominant, the corporate and state, NPR, CPB, no, whatever the state. I haven't watched it in so long, I've forgotten what the state television station is. But they're in control of most of the dominant media, so it won't be a problem there. But there's huge support for Assange by significant intellectuals and political figures, including the previous president of Ecuador. And so there will be a perception management problem. One of the ways in which I've thought about that is that because the documents that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks released are still classified, it's possible that he won't be able to enter them as evidence in a trial, even though the rest of us already have access to them. Well, that would look very bad if it's a public trial. But it's quite likely to be an in-camera trial with no observers, no record, and then he could be thrown in prison for God knows how long.
You know, they go on to write in their letter, particularly disturbed to learn that your government, Ecuador, restored Assange's access to the internet. On numerous occasions, Assange has compromised the national security of the United States. You talk about an image management problem. I'm really thinking about now the United States is trying to find a way to cover Crown Prince MBS. They're trying to salvage him, and now they want Julian Assange deported. Talk about an image management problem.
Exactly. And Trump is saying as best as he can that the top Saudi sheikh, what's his name?
MBS.
Okay. That he didn't know about it, that he just got some rogue operatives.
Right. Wow. Let's get to your, this is really interesting. So folks can just Google this letter came out today, and this is really a move that I wasn't expecting. And this is really being done. Apparently, these members of the House Committee on Foreign Relations were just really upset that Ecuador has partially reinstated Julian Assange's access to the internet, and so now they're demanding that he be extradited. This is really, really, really frightening in terms of freedom of speech and so many other issues that are tangential to this. You've written a piece entitled Congo in the Abyss in Black Agenda Report. It's an account of your interview with Swiss Congolese historian and activist, and help me with the name, Benedict Kumbi
Njoko. Kumbi Njoko, yeah.
Thank you. About recent developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Njoko says, Today, some observers speak of Congo as a post-conflict country, but it's still in a low-intensity conflict, on and off, hot and cold. A conflict that drags on like this can become even deadlier than declared war. What's going on there now and why?
Well, in the Beni territory, which is in the north of North Kivu province, there have been many massacres recently. It seems that Uganda is the likely, well, Uganda and Rwanda are the likely aggressors there. It's possible that they're competitive. That has happened before. But Uganda and Rwanda have been in the eastern Congo with U.S. and U.K. and allied support since 1996 when they invaded. That war ended in 1997. They invaded again in 1998. That war ended in 2003. The president who was installed was assassinated shortly thereafter. And his adopted son became president, and he was much more compliant to Rwandan, Ugandan, and U.S. interests. So this is an extension of all that. Excuse me. The enormous mineral wealth of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is concentrated in its eastern provinces. And the two most tortured are probably North and South Kivu provinces, which are on the Rwandan, Ugandan, and Burundian borders. Today, here's something that came out in the news today. Rwanda is doing some sort of perception management effort about the source of the coltan, Colombian tantalite, this is a mineral that's very important to electronics.
It's what makes cell phones.
Yeah, exactly. And it's important now to renewable energy technology. The greatest concentration in the world is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and in the Kivu provinces. Now, Rwanda, which neighbors Kivus, is the number one exporter of coltan. And they're claiming that it's mined in Rwanda, which is a tiny little country on the border of DRC.
You found, tying this back to Julian Assange, you have gone through WikiLeaks files and found some very interesting files through WikiLeaks related to the recent incidents in Congo.
Right, exactly. And one of the main subjects of my piece, or actually my interview with BK, who is extremely eloquent there, so I hope people will go and find the piece, the interview, in the Black Agenda Report. But we talked about the way gender issues are used to manage perception, to manipulate the narrative about this part of the world. And it's always to manipulate it away from imperial aggression, that of the Western nations particularly. And something that happened, I think it was last week, Dr. Denis Mukwege won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's known as the man who heals women. He is a gynecologist who set up Pansy Hospital in South Kivu province to operate on women who had been horrifically damaged by rape. And he has also helped women in other nations in various ways who have been the victims of rape and conflict. And he totally deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. However, as BK said, there's something cynical about this because it's part of the narrative that focuses on women and the suffering of women in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, which distracts from the genocide against the people.
In fact, he says it's an organized, staged reality that obliterates the imperial aggression in Congo and encourages a global consensus to stop the rapes but continue the war. I found that to be incredibly, incredibly insightful because he makes that comparison in a couple of instances. Also how he talks about the way that men in Congo, or Congo, was described as the rape capital of the world. And he says, so the focus is on the act. It's not, it totally ignores the war and how that is being used as an agent of war, and the focus should be to stop the war.
Exactly. But one thing first, the person I interviewed is a woman, a French name for a woman. Most people can think about that because Benedict is a male name without the E in English.
Ah, thank you for that clarity.
She's a Congolese woman who fled to Europe with her family when she was a child. They sought political asylum and received it. She now lives in Switzerland, where she's a historian and teacher, but she's still very vocal and active in the affairs of her homeland. And one fact about her story is that her father went back to Congo and disappeared. But she's still very involved. In fact, she got thrown out of an assembly, a UN assembly, because she interrupted Ban Ki-moon, who was going on and on and on with this kind of meaningless NGO speak about the problems in Congo. Another one of the main participants in this is the NGO industrial complex. They put constant focus on the suffering of women, which, as we've just said, emphasizes taking care of the women, stopping the rape, and letting the war continue, and obscuring the causes of the war and the superpowers who are pulling the strings and benefiting from the illegal mineral extraction. It obscures their role.
So we have just about 2 minutes left. What are the two major points that you want the reader to take away from your article in Black Agenda Report, Congo in the Abyss? What is it that you want the reader to walk away from understanding?
I'd actually like it to swing it back to Assange because we were doing this, I started reading WikiLeaks on Assange, and I immediately came up with a document that was very, very pertinent. It's a document about UN and EU objectives, specifically Belgian objectives. I'm sure you know that Belgium has a long, long history in this part of the world.
Hence the Belgian Congo.
Yes. And this is about the way that they're going to address gender issues and, you know, basically how they're going to help women, how they're going to address women's suffering, et cetera, et cetera. And at the very top of this doc, it says right out that it's a psyops. Meaning psychological
operation
to control the perceptions of people in the region and outside the region in a way that's favorable to the agenda of those who are mounting the psychological operation.
And that's why they want Julian Assange to be extradited. And Garrison, thank you so much. Congo in the Abyss, go to Black Agenda Report. It's a fantastic, fantastic piece. It's an accounting of an interview. Fantastic insight. And Garrison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We're back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Did you know that the U.S. is completing construction of a $1 million drone base in Agadez, Niger? If so, do you know why? Well, to get answers to these questions and some others, we turn to my next guest. He's an attorney who writes for Black Agenda Report, Mark Fanscher. Mark, welcome to The Critical Hour.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You have a great piece in Black Agenda Report entitled Deadly, Cowardly U.S. Drone Wars in Africa. You open with the statement, "War is romantic only when it is limited to the confines of a sanitized imagination." What's the correlation between that statement and drone warfare?
Well, the reality of war is a horrible, horrific, terrible, unspeakable type of reality that leaves in its wake destruction, death, calamity, all of the worst things that one can imagine. But at the same time, when we look at movies about war, those that come out of Hollywood, very often war is glamorized. It's romanticized. It portrays plays that feature, you know, stunningly handsome heroes who are engaged in conquering, you know, demonic kinds of enemies and foes and rescuing their comrades from danger. I mean, it's a great adventure. And that reality can last only as long as a person does not witness or observe personally the realities of war firsthand. So when we talk about drone warfare, it preserves for those who don't want to deal with the realities of war this fantasy, this idealized notion of war, because they don't have to actually look at it. They can operate, they can attack, they can engage in warfare remotely without ever having to come face to face with their victims.
This reminds me of two quotes attributable to former President George W. Bush about the invasion of Iraq. He said, "Mark my words, when the dust settles and the smoke clears, history will look back on the Iraq War as a total blast." And in the same speech, he went on, "Withdrawing from Iraq when we're all having such a fantastic time would only serve to empower those intent on spoiling our fun." He said, I have to say right now, we're having a ball. He was selling this. I think he also said, or if it wasn't George Bush, it was Donald Rumsfeld. He said, "This is going to be fun."
Oh, it's great fun for guys who never actually served in the military, or if they did, they never actually went to war. It's great fun if you're sitting in the Pentagon, in a war room where you don't actually have to look at the blood and the death and the destruction that you're causing. I mean, it's great fun if you're sitting in the Oval Office and you're not having to deal with babies who've been blasted to bits by bombs and shrapnel. So, yeah, it's great fun, but you ask the people who are on the receiving end of warfare, and sometimes even the soldiers who have to go to the front lines and engage in combat, and they'll sing a very different song.
And you go on to write, to your earlier point, "Notwithstanding the actual horror of civilian deaths, the U.S. apparently believes this loss of life is less horrible if nobody, not even soldiers, are able to see it. George W. Bush used remotely controlled lethal armed drones, but it was Barack Obama who, with his kill list in hand, became the king of drones." Now, Americans were sold on this idea of drone warfare as antiseptic, sterile warfare, precision airstrikes. Talk about that, please.
That's the great lie, the great myth, that you can have your cake and eat it too. You can program these drones to seek out and to destroy the truly bad guys, the terrorists, those who are causing so much calamity and harm. And you can strike with precision, and you can at the same time avoid any risk of having any of your own soldiers killed in the process. I mean, what could be better than that? But the reality has proven to be very different from that. What has been demonstrated is that in the same way that bombs always take out those who are bystanders, those who are civilians and non-combatants, the drones do exactly the same thing. And those who are independent investigators who've checked into the death toll of civilians with respect to drones that have been launched by both George W. Bush and Barack Obama show that hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians have died as a result of these attacks.
In fact, using what I think they call it the Stingray technology, where they use the drone as a rogue cell tower, and are you familiar with that?
Only vaguely.
Oh, okay. Well, so the the combatant that they're looking for has a cell phone and a cell number. And so what they do is they program that cell number into the drone. The drone then operates as a cell tower. And so when the combatant, the target, uses the phone, the drone locks in on that number. And they call it, to use more sterile language, they call it killing phones. They don't call it killing people. They call it killing phones. But what they don't seem to understand in other cultures, the cell phone is not as personal in African countries and in Middle Eastern countries as it is here in the United States. So the target that they're looking for might actually that day have given the phone to his nephew, given the phone to his niece, given the phone to the next door neighbor, because not everybody has cell phones. Go ahead.
Oh, and not to mention the people who may be in close proximity at the time of the attack.
There you go.
Who also are killed by it. You know, the other thing related to the calculations of the number of civilian deaths has to do with the method of calculation. I believe it was the New York Times that reported that there are occasions when the Obama administration would count all military-aged men who were in the proximity of the bombing attack as combatants, whether they were actually combatants or not. Mm-hmm. There was a presumption that they were, unless after their deaths there was some evidence that would show that, in fact, they were not. So the count of civilian deaths is probably substantially, there's probably an undercount when you take that into consideration.
And you have data in your piece about the number of civilian deaths from the New America Foundation and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. You've got the data, and then as well as the New York Times, in your piece. So now let's move to what's going on in Africa with the United States building this, as you say, $100 million drone base. Where is it being built and why?
Well, it's being built in a city called Agadez in Niger. And, you know, there is, substantial controversy about why the U.S. military is in Niger in the first place. If you ask them, they'll tell you that it's a hotbed of terrorist activity and other types of criminal activity, and that they are there in order to provide support to the Nigerian army and military to help them combat these things. But for those of us who have watched the movements of U.S. military operations globally for some time, that just doesn't add up. You know, as a practical matter, the U.S. doesn't usually send troops just to any old place just because there's violence going on. I mean, there's violent activity and terrorist activity going on all over the place. And for the U.S., which has never been concerned historically about Africa at all, except for purposes of exploiting it or stealing from it or enslaving its people, you know, for it to suddenly have this benevolent interest in protecting people from terrorism when there is no connection necessarily directly between what's going on there and any threats to U.S. interests strikes us as strange. But if you dig a little deeper, what you find out is that in a nearby city called Arlit, there are extensive uranium mining operations that are being conducted and have been maintained by the French for some years. The French have lots of troops in that region, and it's pretty clear that the reason that they're there is not necessarily for purposes of combating terrorism, but to protect their mining operations from anybody who might style themselves a terrorist or anybody else who might want to disrupt them. The United States has always collaborated with France with respect to military operations in Africa, most recently and most notably in Libya. And so the fact that the U.S. has 800 troops or had 800 troops in Niger comes as no big surprise when you take all of that into account. But things have changed recently, and so that accounts for the reason for the development of this new drone base. And a lot of it has to do with what happened roughly a year ago when four U.S. soldiers were killed in an ambush.
the U.S. is following France into Niger the same way the U.S. followed France into Vietnam in the 50s. And nobody seems to be learning from history.
Oh, it's a very good comparison. And, it's to some extent sort of a partnership. They're sort of one hand washing the other kind of a situation. I mean, in fact, in Libya, if you look at the infamous Hillary Clinton emails, which are available online, at the State Department's website, you find an exchange of emails between Clinton staffers and others where they're talking about French interest in Libya. And there is quite frank discussion of the fact that there is concern that a gold-backed currency, Pan-African currency, mm-hmm. that Muammar Gaddafi was hoping to establish would destabilize the franc and throw French economics into chaos. And beyond that, they also had their eyes set on Libya's oil. And so it's a pretty clear lead up to what happened in Libya with respect to the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi.
And water as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So from what I've read, some of the purest water in the world runs in aquifers under Libya. And that's what Gaddafi was using to aerate the desert. He was planting, farming the desert using the water from these Libyan aquifers.
Yes, and so the U.S. has been in communication with the French about these things and their interest and vice versa. And so they're partners in these activities in Africa. And so it comes as no big surprise that the U.S. would be in Niger as well.
So talk a little bit about the building of this drone base in the larger context of AFRICOM.
Well, AFRICOM from the outset has been based on a very astute observation that the Pentagon has made about the United States and its stomach for war. They've determined that notwithstanding a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the the huffing and puffing that you hear coming from the U.S. public, that the U.S. really has a very low threshold for tolerance of deaths of U.S. soldiers. And so AFRICOM was created for the purpose of using African countries' militaries as proxies to promote U.S. interests. So AFRICOM would send its troops into Africa for the purpose of training and directing African armies to carry out missions that were regarded as in the interest of the U.S. So this was a way of promoting, by military means, U.S. interests, and at the same time avoiding the risk to U.S. troops, because the people who were being used as cannon fodder, the ones who were on the front lines, were African soldiers. So when you come to Niger and you have four U.S. soldiers who are killed in an ambush, then that sends Washington into a tizzy. There were senators and others who, after those deaths, said that they didn't even know mm-hmm. that there were 800 troops in Niger. And so now they've got four deaths and a lot of explaining to do to the U.S. public about why they're there. And what the government knows is that there is no good explanation that would be satisfactory or palatable to the U.S. public. I mean, what are they going to do? Say, well, we're there because we're protecting you from terrorism. Well, these particular terrorists in that region have never come over to America. They've never done anything to us directly. Well, we're there to protect uranium mining operations of the French. Why? There are no good reasons or explanations for that. And so what they have decided to do is to substitute drones for troops. What they have begun within the recent weeks is the withdrawal in significant numbers of U.S. troops from Africa as a whole. And at the same time, they're building this drone base, which is going to launch drones into regions that have not seen drones before in Africa.
In fact, you write, unlike previous administrations, the Trump CIA will not limit its drone attacks to conventional war zones. All of this means civilian populations are endangered in regions of Africa that have not been drone target areas in the past.
And it's a scary thing because, you know, if this happens and there is little outcry or little resistance, it will only encourage more extensive use of these things for who knows what purpose. And, you know, a lot of innocent people face the prospect of dying.
In the end, the U.S., you're writing, the U.S. recognizes that the deaths of even four anonymous U.S. soldiers in Niger caused extraordinary pain for their families, which in turn created broad public resistance to U.S. war ventures in Africa. So there really has to be much more information. There has to be much more protest. But even so, there's just too much money to be made on the continent. And now they see that they can replace the humans with technology.
Yes, and it's all wrongheaded. I mean, because much of it has to do with a jockeying for position on the African continent. One of the things that made the U.S. very nervous were the advances made by China, the inroads that China made in developing relationships with African countries and getting access to Africa's resources. China's approach has been to come into Africa and to deal with African leadership in a respectful kind of a way. One might question their motives, one might question their agenda, but they've been respectful in the way that they've done it, and they've tried to, at least on the surface, deal with African countries fairly. The U.S. is not accustomed to dealing with Africans in that way. Historically, the U.S. has dealt with Africa as a continent to be conquered, a continent to be overpowered, and the only language that they really understand is the use of military. So it has placed them in something of a predicament. They've not necessarily had the ability to use U.S. troops to carry out their domination of the continent, but they've tried to find substitutes. First, African troops, and now they're going to use drones.
And you end your piece, which I think is a brilliant assessment. Although the U.S. wants no more of its own youths to die, it is leaving behind drone operations that have the potential to kill hundreds, if not thousands, of African civilians out of sight and out of mind of a U.S. population that would be horrified if only they could see the twisted, mangled, and shredded bodies of innocent Africans. It is perhaps the ultimate profile in cowardice. We have about 45 seconds left. Your thoughts, Mark?
No, only that I think that all of us who are concerned about these things need to learn more about them in the first instance and talk about them more. Notwithstanding the ignorance that exists about Africa in the U.S., on the most basic level, people everywhere have a remaining sense of decency will drive them to prevent crimes being committed in their names if they know the full extent of them. And I think the more we talk about it, the more likely we will be able to stop it.
Mark Fancher, great, great piece in Black Agenda Report. I want to thank you for your time today and look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Hey, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe, peace, and blessings. I'm out.